You know, it's pretty simple.
Good afternoon. I'm opening a meeting of the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee on Tuesday, March 7th, 2017. And I gaveled at the wrong time, so here we are. Anyway, lots of gaveling today. Today we do have an informational hearing on the agenda and from a variety of reports today, and learn about connective pathways that link students to high schools, post-secondary schools, to careers beyond schooling, how it ties into needs of business. And I am very excited. We're going to start with a presentation. I haven't done that part yet. Sorry, I'm opening an informational hearing. And our first testimony today, I met these folks on my travels last year back to Colorado and Alberta, Canada. But very impressed with what they're doing in Colorado. It's driven a lot of my thinking. And so very happy that they were willing to meet with us today and share what they're doing. So they are here by Skype, as you can tell, and they are key players in Colorado's recent efforts to better align their workforce system with business and education. And so I'd like to welcome Stephanie and Jeff. Oh, I'm not sure how, I've never done a meeting quite like this, so you're on.
Thank you, Representative.
Just one second.
See you again.
Excuse me, just one second. Members, there is a document posted on OLIS, and it has informational links to their presentation. And so if you'd like to follow along on your computer, you can do that. And we'll see how this goes. Okay. All right. Good afternoon.
Hey, can they see us?
My name is Jeff Lawson. I'm the chair of the Colorado Business Roundtable with Stephanie Beck, who you'll hear from. And she really talked about the meat bones of Colorado workforce development, working role. There's a lot of stats, a lot of statistics about workforce and the disconnect. I think the big things that I really want to highlight, dealing with potential of going to have a number of jobs. We're dealing with disconnect and the negative impact that are approaching upon family businesses, economic industry, family institutions. This is really the position of our business roundtable organization. You have done.
Excuse me, Jeff, just a second.
Understand.
Jeff.
This is workforce development, human capital. Jeff, go ahead.
I'm going to ask you to keep going, but we are really having a hard time hearing you here. And I understand that our technical staff is downstairs trying to tweak things in a way, but there's just a little bit of a delay. So your presentation is wonderful. The sound quality is really annoying. So, but let's go ahead. We'll listen extra hard.
You bet. I shifted the mic. That'll pick up the sound a little bit better. So if I don't have great eye contact into the camera, I'm trying to speak down into the mic. There is better. Colorado understands this particular issue. And so in 2015 and 2016, we ran a series of workforce bills. It really kind of became a ballot capital. It really crossed that risk divide. People around. We ran basically 13 bills. 2015, 10 bills, 16.
Go ahead and make it.
Not all were law, but they were very far in establishing some of the things Stephanie and her organization
hey,
got
Jeff.
To get some of them got on her lap.
Jeff.
Whether she was ready
Jeff.
For that, but that's what you got to do.
Jeff, this is terrible here. I need to indulge us just a little bit. What I'd like to do is give our technical staff time to work on this system, because I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say. And so I'd like to close this part and open up the next topic on our agenda, and then we'll come back to you if that's all right.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. So I'm closing. No, I don't have to close anything, do I? Okay. If we could invite up the higher education institutions and hear your perspectives, that would be Donna Llewellyn, Jessica Howard, Dave McDonald, Carleen Drago Starr and Kyle Cole. If we could. Can we fit five up there? Do we... Well, I already called them up. If you want to do three and two, that's fine. That's, we're very flexible here.
Okay, great.
Sadly, that's the most impressive thing about me, I think.
No, I don't know. Ready? I know how to do it. Chair Raden and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Donna Lewelling. I'm the Education Division Director for the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'm pleased to be with you today to provide some framing of what I hope will be helpful information regarding career pathways here in Oregon. I will be joined by various friends and partners. Jessica Howard, she'll introduce herself in a little bit, as well as some colleagues and friends from the universities. And there are partners in post-secondary education. And as such, I'll do my best to be brief in my portion so that you can hear from those who are on the ground developing the partnerships and building the pathways directly with the students. This first slide is really an overarching statement related to career pathways and the underlying goals that are related to our work on building pathways for Oregon. Career pathways are a series of connected education programs and student supports enabling individuals to get the training they need to secure a job or advance in a demand industry or occupation. We also have some goals associated with those around increasing the number of Oregonians with certificates, credentials, and degrees in demand occupations, as well as easing student transitions from high school to community colleges and from pre-college to credit post-secondary. You likely often hear career pathways being described as a system that is focused on the coordination of people and resources both within and across education, workforce, and human services systems. Within education, this includes aligning the K-12 and post-secondary education systems, and in particular, the career and technical education programs and services provided within and across program providers. The HEC recognizes that this cannot be done without supports for key transition points. These supports include things within areas such as pre-college outreach, accelerated learning, academic transitions, and career and post-secondary training programs. This next slide is really highlighting some of the various terms you may hear in some of your conversations related to career pathways. We've actually provided you a handout of definitions, so I won't spend a lot of time going into depth, but briefly, These particular terms come from a variety of places. The WIOA career pathways definition that is included in the federal law. We also have the Community College Career Pathways Initiative, which is a student-centered, demand-driven innovation that community colleges launched years ago to proactively adapt to the dynamically changing needs of students and employers. You'll hear terms such as guided pathways, which is a model based on coherent and easy to follow college level programs of study that are aligned with requirements for success in employment at the next stage of education. You'll also probably hear the term program of study, which is designed by secondary and post-secondary partners to be non-duplicative, emphasize technical, academic, and career knowledge and skills that are acquired through a sequence of secondary and post-secondary instruction. From time to time, you'll probably hear reference related to career pathways funding for K-12, which is part of a bill that was passed, House Bill 3072. It's intended that those funds allocated through that program incentivize intensive CTE programs of study that lead to high wage and high demand occupations. And then further, you might also hear from time to time the term Career Pathways Certificate of Completion, which is a reference to short-term certificates that are 12 to 44 credits in length that can be completed in 2 to 4 terms and can be stacked to an associate's degree. I just provide you this information along with the handout so that you kind of have an understanding of how the various terms relate to one another. The pathways that are supported by programs are grounded in the collaborations between education and training. And we talked a little bit about this. As you can imagine, our students enter the post-secondary pathway from various points and in many places. This particular slide talks about our enrollment at the post-secondary institutions. Over 32,000 of Oregon's 18 to 19 year olds are enrolled in public higher education, and you'll see that the majority of those are in community colleges, and approximately 7,339 actually are in public universities. But it's important to note that that reflects less than half of our current student population. The next slide really talks about the diversity of those high school students. You'll see that 61% are white, but you'll also see that we have a growing Latina or Hispanic population. 17% of those students are in that background, 5% Asian American, and you'll see multiracial, or some students choose not to report, at 6%. You'll see that the majority are over 53% are female, and you'll see that there's a little bit of a difference to in how they enroll at the post-secondary institutions, depending on full-time and part-time. We also have returning adults to our post-secondary education, and we thought it might be helpful for you to see some information related to our adult basic education students. 31% of those students are employed, and 39% are actually employed or unemployed but looking for work. They are traditionally in the area of between 25 or they're in the age of 25 to 44. That's a significant amount of the population is in that area, so they're in that middle age group. You'll see that there are an additional 12 to 15% older, 45 to 59, and then a little bit more for 60%.
Can we interrupt?
Sorry, I didn't see you.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have the breakdown of, as far as, like, I see up here it says 31% employed, 39% unemployed, but do we have that breakdown when it specifically speaks to just rural, where it says 44% or urban? Is that data separated anywhere?
You know, I'm Chair Reardon, Representative Hurd, I'm not 100% sure, but I'll go back and ask that question, and if it's available, we'll get it back to you.
Right, thank you.
And you could share that with Laura and get her to all of us.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So you'd like the employment status based on geography?
Separated okay. Rural versus, or, sorry, through the chair.
Okay. Any other questions on that slide before I move forward? And we just spoke a little bit about the geography piece. About 57% are in urban and 44% in rural. Also, a lot of our students who come to the post-secondary institutions are GED graduates. We had 9,100 students who took the GED test last year. Of those, 66% were unemployed. 73% reported annual income of $5,000 or less. That was a pretty outstanding statistic for me personally. 39% reported a family member influenced them to obtain their GED. 58% of the students were male. And I think it's important to point out that the average age of GED test takers was 24 years old.
Yes. Thank you, Donna, for that information. Do we have data breakdown of our GED graduates in respect to demographics and those who are entering post-secondary education?
In terms of race, ethnicity, in terms of those who took the test last year, or
no, those who are GED graduates who went on to post-secondary.
Don't have it with this presentation, representative, but I will work to get you that for future.
I think everybody would probably like to get this information.
Okay. The next piece that I'll talk to you a little bit briefly about is accelerated learning models. We have three models in the state of Oregon. We have dual credit, sponsored dual credit and assessment-based learning. The information related to those particular models are also included in the definition sheet that we provided you. Dual credit, as defined, is offered as part of a high school program taught by a high school teacher acting as a proxy instructor for the college or university who's been approved by the college university and meets the qualifications to teach the course for the college or university. And the course itself is sufficiently similar to the college university course to enable the student to be described as taking a course from the college or university. Sponsored dual credit is defined, refers to a course that is offered as part of the high school program taught by a high school teacher in partnership with a sponsoring college or university faculty member who meets the qualifications to teach the course for the college or university and is sufficiently similar to the college university course to enable the student to be described as taking a course from the college or university. And then assessment-based learning is defined as those that are enhanced high school courses or other activities offered at the high school and taught by high school teachers, a partnership that focuses on the academic attainment of specific college or university defined student learning outcomes and the opportunity for students to demonstrate through college or university assessment that they have attained those student learning outcomes and thereby earn credit for a course from the sponsoring college or university. And the next slides talk a little bit about those students. We had over 40,000 students who took dual credit courses in 2015-16. The majority of those were done at the community colleges. We are seeing a rising number of dual credit students as these models increase. And then the final graphic on here talks about the course fields in which they took the majority of those dual credit courses. Once again, as you can imagine, our dual credit students, they also range widely. We had students who took 8 credits on average pass 95% of their dual credit courses. As you can see, there's the race, ethnicity background. And once again, we have women at 53% and men at 43% in the dual credit enrollment. And that concludes my portion of this, and I'll turn it over to my colleague, Jessica.
Thank you, Chair Reardon and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Howard. I am the campus president for Portland Community College Southeast Campus at 82nd and Division in Portland. Much of what I've prepared for you today is covering the same material as Donna has just covered, but from a slightly different angle. And so there'll be a little bit of duplication, but I hope that you'll get an even more robust picture of what pathways are at the community colleges in Oregon. So I'd like to preface this by saying that community colleges are a bridge more than they are a destination. They get people from where they are to where they want to be, from pre-college into college, from college into university, or college into jobs. And so really pathways and progress along them is what we do. So not dissimilarly with Donna, I have divided this large subject of pathways into 3 different parts: pathways from high school into college, guided pathways, and got career pathways. So pathways from high school into college. When we think of those pathways, we typically think of accelerated learning, as you've just heard, in which high school students can earn college credits early. And the thinking behind that is that they will then be encouraged to continue that learning in college after high school. In Oregon, as you've heard, this can occur through a variety of means: advanced placement, international baccalaureate, dual credit, supervised dual credit, assessment-based learning credit. College credits are also earned by students who are high school students who are located on the college campus through models such as early college, in which students are integrated into a number of existing courses on campus, and through expanded options. The Perkins Act has a mandate to create programs of study that span grades 9 through 14, and this has resulted in well-defined and articulated pathways in career and technical education from high school into college. The great majority of competitive careers in CTE depend upon post-secondary education and training, so dual credit pathways in CTE are particularly important. Bridge programs also play a role in transitioning high school students to college with or without a credit classroom component. Future Connect, with its success coaches and summer meetings, demonstrates this kind of pathway type approach. And again, this is some of the data you've just seen that shows the tremendous increase over the past decade in dual credit acquisition by high schoolers in Oregon. So I'd like to go to then the career pathways portion of the conversation. Almost this exact definition was on an earlier slide. So let's go to the next one. Career pathways are not the purview of any one institution or type of institution or sector. This slide shows how different career pathways systems connect and interrelate. It also shows that people enter pathways not just from high school, but as adults with or without a GED or credential.
Could you hold that slide just for a minute?
Sure.
So that would be one career pathway for one career or one career field or...
Yes, Representative Reardon, it's a good question because it's not as... I think it's... This slide is attempting to show the systems. And so you can have people who come from high school and go right to university. You can have people who come from high school and who still require some pre-college work, who then go to the community college, who then might end up in organized labor training. You can have people who come from high school and go right into workforce training and get industry-recognized credentials without having come to college or university. So these are systems in which people go from one kind of sector of institution or operation into another. You know, I think when it's, and so it depends entirely upon, well, a number of factors. One is through which door is the student coming? Are they coming from a workforce center? Are they coming through, are they going directly to a university? When do they drop out or reengage, which is not uncommon? And how do all these things interrelate? So when we talk about pathway, I think it's something that sounds very, very linear, but in actual fact, it's really about, a lot of this is about the individual making the path between these systems that ideally are connected, integrated, and that relate to one another.
We have another question, but Rep. Alonzo Leon, go ahead.
Okay, I don't want to ruin
you. Oh, no.
Okay. if we can go back to the very first the slide prior to this, before that, I guess. Yeah, this one. I just want to... I guess understand when you talk about high school to college or high school students, are you referring to high school students who are going to graduate from and get a high school diploma, or high school students who are also on the path to getting their GED and going on to college?
Chair Reardon and Representative Alonzo Leon, the majority of students in our high schools do graduate. And so in many cases, this is referring to that group. However, there are students who are not on track to get a high school diploma for one reason or another. There are a number of different pathways that they can take. One is to go to a so-called alternative high school that may be a part of the existing school district. They might be the kind of student who would do extremely well in a college setting, even though they don't have their high school equivalent completion yet, because they have more independence. Then the students in that category might come to a gateway to college program, for instance. Some students who come are not going to get their high school diploma because, for instance, they do not speak English as their native language, and they may have arrived in the middle of high school. And so those folks may, again, be served through GED programs that may or may not come through the community college. So there again, it's another, if we were to put up another picture, it would look kind of like the one that was up there. There are options, and a lot of it depends upon what the student prefers, what the high schools allow as in terms of those connections.
Thank you.
I hope that helps.
Thank you.
So back to the career paths, if we could. That one. So is there one of those per industry or one of those per... Would there be some sort of a business sector identified with that?
Representative Reardon, excellent question. And if I may go to the next slide, I think maybe we'll see a little more clarity. Or
so excited.
I hope. Okay. This is an important slide because it shows that the whole career pathways systems are driven by industry needs and sector strategies. So you can see in the lower left is the image we saw before. In the right, we see the industry cluster with its needs and evolving needs. And then the sector partnerships, which are occurring by region and which are more strategic. And the way that these systems work and remain viable and relevant is for them all to influence one another. Without industry influencing the pathway system, then we are not creating individuals that are ready for the jobs that industry has. So this whole kind of cycle is very important. And career pathways and career technical education are all as connected to workforce as possible, to jobs, to employers, to industry as possible in order to stay relevant.
I agree.
Could you go back one, just because it was so small, and my eyes apparently are not what they used to be. So, and that's the same thing that's in the lower part of the next one, right? Okay, that's what I thought. So one question I have is, if somebody were, like myself or Representative Hurd, owners of businesses, where would I plug in their... Is it workforce training, or if I'm not planning to be considered the labor part, I'm planning to be the entrepreneur part, mm-hmm. where do I plug in?
So Chair Reardon and Representative Clem, there are, and the other slide I think shows a little bit in terms of kind of the macro level, but for instance, at the community college, every single career and technical degree is required to have an advisory board made up of employers. Mm-hmm. And those advisory boards they advise every single career and technical program. There are obviously connections between the other systems there, workforce training, organized labor training, that are very, very connected to employers' needs as well.
So, sorry. I mean, if I'm the kid...
Oh, yes.
And I want to become my own business person. Maybe I don't even want to go to college. I want to learn enough to start my own. Mm-hmm. I'm Bill Gates, and I can't quite hack it in college. So I'm in my garage, and I found Microsoft. I'm not sure. I may be mixing him and Steve Jobs at this point. But one of them never finished college. I know that. So how do we talk about entrepreneurs when we're describing pathways to success? Because I don't want to work for anybody else. I like exactly the way I did it, but I don't know where I would go as a kid who wants to work for myself on this map.
Well, Chair Reardon, Representative Clem, I would take a stab at this by saying, of course, there are many answers to that question. One that comes to mind is that, of course, if one is under or unemployed, the workforce training area there is going to be a place with lots of resources. Another resource that is located in the community colleges across the state of Oregon are small business development centers,
right,
and they provide free one-on-one business advising.
Yeah.
There are also, I know that at PCC, we offer an entrepreneurialism certificate that mm-hmm. feeds into our business degree. And again, that is a career and technical program. So there are a variety of options.
Okay.
Any questions?
I'm afraid to ask, but I feel compelled. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clem's question, and I'm wondering about the pathway for individuals who have been incarcerated. And so that is a piece that I don't know if the HEC is coordinating that, if the Department of Corrections is coordinating that, but we definitely have a need, especially for that. It's likely that 35% of our kids who are not graduating are somewhere on that map. And how do we get them to fully engage in the workforce with their needs being met? So that may be a question more for you, Rep Reardon. So.
Was I supposed to have the answer to that?
Well, you know, yes.
Sure.
I think perhaps Rep Solman has the answer to that.
I don't.
Thanks.
Can I have a question?
I know, just from personal experience, I know at the county level, when I toured Clackamas County jails, they have programs that work with the prison, with the jail
partnership
prisoners, and they're working with directly with Clackamas Community College. So that's one example of before they even get out, training them up for job skills. So that's and I believe there's also programs within the prisons, but I don't know that. That'd be a great thing to follow up on.
Chair Reardon, I'd like to add, as the former GD administrator, we worked in collaboration with all the community colleges and Department of Corrections, so that people in our correctional facilities would have an opportunity to get their GED. Okay. And then equally work with our community colleges so that they could take courses and essentially potentially earn degrees through the community colleges.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Chair. I would also want to add piggyback on that because, you know, just to be able to say that we need to do better by those that have served their time. I won't go into this. There is a direct example of that of a constituent in my district who has clearly done that and really actually has three college degrees but is not able to get a job. But on the other side of that, I wanted to say that I am very excited about these slides. I think I just really appreciate the information. And I think the conversations or the questions really also say that this diagram I love, and I love the second one too, specifically, but also saying that we need to do better by our students even looking back in high school and working in that way, which I think kind of talks to what Representative Clem was saying, is how can we connect those students in that, you know, early on as well. So that's the exciting part of CT in that direction. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Anything else?
Yes.
Okay.
So as stated earlier, for community colleges, everything we do is about pathways to career. But when you hear community colleges use the term career pathways, and Donna referenced this earlier, we mean something quite specific. Career pathways in Oregon are the result of a focused initiative in career and technical education over the last 10 years, and it's an initiative for which we continue to receive national attention. Specifically, we've developed a statewide strategy to create these short-term college certificates that lead to in-demand occupations, and they stack to the next highest level of degree or certificate. The career pathways approach, as Donna said, eases the transitions between high school and college, between college and university, or college and employment, and it's also been a targeted investment in supporting learning for low-skilled adults. It includes accelerated, contextualized approaches and opportunities for work-based learning. The next slide does a good job of showing how tiers of stacking certificates are associated with differing levels of jobs and how career pathways build upon themselves. I don't know if you can see this, but in the blue circles, you see low-skilled jobs, semi-skilled jobs, middle-skilled jobs, etc. And the credentials are stacking one on top of each other. As much as we're inclined to view educational pathways as linear experiences, in actual fact, people are working, they're having children, they have real-life issues, and they come in and out of our institutions. So offering short-term credentials that stack and that lattice, which means that they can go to more than one next step, provides that multiple entry and exit points that we referred to earlier in career pathways. Now, the next slide will show you, this is one map. It's one of our career pathways roadmaps. It shows how students, how certificates stack, and how completion points connect to industry needs in Oregon. This is Rogue Community College's Industrial Welding Technology Map. And there's one of these for every single career pathway. If you look at the start, the person can say, you know, I think I want to try and be a welder's helper. It's 16 credits. Definitely. That's one term. They can click on there to understand not only what are those 16 credits, but what happens after they get the 16 credits. They go to the far right. There they have, there's a link to welder's helper, fabricator helper, pipe fitter helper, etc. And so there's a sense then of what will that certificate help them to be competitive for. If they have success in that 16-credit certificate, they can decide instead, you know what, I've succeeded here. I think I'd like to do the next step along this educational journey rather than go right out into the work world. It depends on kind of where they are in their life. Then the next option will be the Industrial Welding Technology Certificate, which is 45 to 49 credits. You can see it's about three times as long as Welder's Helper. And upon that completion, they're qualified to test to become a certified welder. And that's an industry-recognized credential. Once they do that, you see there are a whole other list of welders and jobs over there on the far right.
Here we have a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just referenced industry recognized certificate. Who determines that? Is there a specific welders union association or someone?
Yes, Chair Reardon and Representative Hurd. Yes, those are established by the industry. You may have more information, Donna, than I do. We try to embed them in our college credentialing, our college certificates, so that it's part of the overall educational experience.
Chair Reardon and Representative Hurd, in this specific example, that industry certification is actually issued by the American Welding Society, and they set the standards for the industry credential.
So, brief follow-up. So it's a universal acceptance or accreditation, and are all community colleges and whatnot, are they all following that and that offer welding classes and whatnot, so everybody's on the same page and it's all recognized to be the same, oh wow, you have that, we want to hire you type situation?
So Chair Reardon, Representative Hurd, I believe the answer is yes, but I'd want to follow up with each individual.
Several nodding heads, so
I believe the answer for this particular credential is yes.
Thank you.
Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I get you to go back to the last slide, please? With the little blue circles at the bottom there, these are increasingly skilled credentials, right? Or
yes.
That are stackable,
right.
That can equal the AA.
Right, the AAS.
Okay, and then you, at the very end, you've got the arrow there that actually is a BA or BS, okay, mm-hmm. Right? I mean, these could lead into a Bachelor's of Science,
yes.
And or Arts and so forth. What's the process? How realistic is it that if you acquire your stackable credentials and get your AA, enroll at the next level, that you're only going to need an additional 90 credits to finish that BA or BS?
Chair Reardon and Representative Johnson, I think this is something that we're actively working on. I think some of those articulations are really reliant upon the relationship between the local community college and the local university.
Okay, good answer.
Could we go to the next slide? I just had a question on that. So if is this available to the student and yes. and the counselor?
Yes, Representative Reardon, all these are online. And they're not just at Rogue. They're at all of our community colleges.
You anticipated my second question then?
Yes.
Okay. Rep. Solman?
I'll be really quick. But I hate to keep saying this, but I love this diagram as well. And I just wonder if we can start to look at, wouldn't it be an awesome opportunity? And is there opportunities out there that you're working with school districts to be able to provide that welder's helper while they're in high school so that they can come into PCC and start on that next rung of the scaffolding or, what'd you say, lattice?
And so Chair Reardon and Representative Solomon, that's exactly what we're doing. Rogue has several of their career pathways that are embedded into the high school. We're working on that at PCC, and that's something that is sort of the next step for our career pathways, because if a high school student can begin here, then they're already getting not only college credit, college credentialing, but if you can see here, industry credentialing, and this can all happen during that entire journey from high school into college. And it's really a very, it's a very practical model because of the stacking and because of the mapping. This whole mapping software is something that has come out of the Oregon Community College Initiative. In fact, Washington State is now using it. It's something that we share. But you can see it goes all the way down to the bachelor's level, and then you can see what those options might be for the student who intends to hopefully get the bachelor's degree. And 80% of students nationwide who come to a community college say that that is their ultimate goal. So what does it mean to get them there, regardless of whether they take the hard left for career technical education or the hard right for lower division transfer? And this kind of mapping is, I think, very important for them to see how that actually works.
Thank you.
Are there other maps other than welding?
Oh, yes, a great many.
How many?
Oh, I have no idea. We have hundreds of career pathway certificates.
Good answer.
Sure have.
Oh my God. I just got a few more slides.
So I have another question. Thank you, Chair. Just for my understanding, do any of these courses ever expire? So let's say somebody starts their path, and then they have a baby, and they take a break. And then life happens. How long do these courses are? Can one, or is there an expiration or a time frame in which somebody needs to complete it so that they don't lose credit?
So, Chair Reardon and Representative Alonso Leon, we are always looking to ensure that the credentials are up to date. So there is, it's always something that is evolving. However, we're very sensitive to the student who leaves and comes back. It depends, I think, a great deal on how the industry is changing. But the good thing about credit coursework is that there is a record of what the course is. And so it may be that you take of that industrial welding technology certificate, you may get one term in, and that's it. Those courses are still there. The learning outcomes are part of what that is. And so it's something that then one builds upon.
But they don't expire, I guess. I think about it, I mean, in grad school, if you don't finish your courses within a certain time frame, they expire and you have to retake that course again. And so just curious if that's an issue here.
Senator Chair Reardon, Representative Alonso Leon, I would say the answer to that is dependent on the program as well as industry. So some industries are changing and they're innovating, and so courses that you may have taken 5 or 6 years ago may no longer be part of the current industry program demands. And so I would say that probably in those instances there probably is a clock on the course.
Thank you.
Now I'd like to just speak very briefly about guided pathways. It may be a term that you all have heard. It's more really of a movement than a specific thing. This is a description. The Guided Pathways Movement is an effort to help colleges and universities provide clearer roadmaps to credentials, specify course sequences, identify progress milestones, establish program learning outcomes, and provide extensive supports and counseling. And I'm hoping that you all are thinking that sounds a lot like career pathways. And it is, except that Guided Pathways is an effort focused essentially on the non-CTE side of the house, lower division transfer, for students who intend to transfer to university to ultimately receive a bachelor's degree. Currently, the great majority of community colleges utilize what can be called a cafeteria approach. You have cafeteria on the left, Guided Pathways on the right. With the cafeteria approach, students often find themselves overwhelmed by options, and they end up making inefficient progress to an often unclear goal with financial consequences. So in Oregon, with our new Student Success Center that is funded and sponsored by Jobs for the Future, the guided pathways is the framework for that student success work, and hopefully it will create greater pathway structure in our lower division programs, just like we have in career technical education and as you saw with career pathways. So this is a work in progress. This represents kind of a large system redesign, if you will, on the lower division transfer side. But the hope is that you will see the kind of clarity and pathway focus for both career technical education and the lower division transfer side of the credit offerings at community colleges. And that concludes my presentation. Happy to take any other questions.
Sure. Oh, excellent.
Thank you, Chair. I was curious when you were talking, is there any conversation regarding school districts that do not have a strong CTE program, you know, within their districts? Is there conversation about how community colleges can partner with those districts to maybe utilize the Measure 98 funds to provide opportunities for students?
Chair Reardon and Representative Solomon, I think that that's a very important conversation to have, particularly considering what a student who is in career and technical education in high school is able to get in terms of a job just from that point. There is so much that that the entire Perkins programs of study model assumes that the programs of study are from grade 9 to grade 14. And so all of that coursework is aligned and directs students to continue on because they're trying to get industry credentials, because they want them to get the college credentials, and then they're really ready to get what I would call competitive CTE jobs. So I think that is a critical piece in that conversation.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much. Both of you have answered a lot of questions that I've had, a lot of interest from this committee, and appreciate your coming down today. So
thank you so much.
We do have three other folks from the Higher Ed Institute perspective. So Dave, Carlene, and Kyle, if you could join us. And is it 4:15? And we did run a little bit long on that part, and we probably about need to finish by about 4:05.
Very good.
But maybe they answered all the questions. So
yes, it is. We're done. Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave McDonald, and I'm the Associate Provost at Western Oregon University. And I've been doing this work in Oregon for about 20 years, and I want to echo a few comments made earlier and then add an observation before I go specifically into what we're doing at my university. I've been in Oregon for about 20 years. I grew up here and then left for a period of self-imposed exile in California. My wife wised me up, and we moved back. In the time I've been back in Oregon, I can recall no other time in which we've had such collaborations, K-12, community colleges, and universities, around student access and success. It has truly been, especially the last 3 years, I think three of the most productive years in my 20 years in Oregon, in terms of us working together around what students need, not what the institutions need, but rather around the students. And so it is, I think, a different place than what we saw even a decade ago, and that's really promising. Specifically, I'm going to talk about one program, the Willamette Promise. It is one of many things that we do at Western Oregon University, including, I think, a flagship program of our Bilingual Teacher Scholars Program, which is really, again, working closely with the school districts to meet one of their pressing needs. The Willamette Promise itself is a three-year-old partnership. It is a different kind of partnership than what Carlene will talk about and other things, in that it is of that newest model of dual credit. So this is a proficiency or assessment-based model. We work very closely with the high school teachers. And in fact, you can see we are working with 40 different school districts. They go from as far away as Clatskanie on the northwest coast, through Portland down into Salem. So we have a wide swath of school districts that we're working with. There are 230 high school teachers. We're teaching 19 college courses, everything from psychology to computer science, Spanish, writing, biology, chemistry. The Oregon Transfer Module type courses is what we've been very intentional. And those are the courses that have the greatest transferability across institutions and the greatest value across majors. And as you can see, we had almost 2,000 students who earned 10,000 college credits this last year.
echoing my comment earlier about the change, 4 years ago, Western Oregon University had zero students earning college credit while in high school. As you can see now, we're a part of an affiliation that has almost 2,000 students doing this. We focus on all students, and intentionally the program was designed to really reach those students who were not actively engaged in IB and AP programs, students who were first generation, students who were low income, students from rural schools, and in fact, a number of our schools, the Willamette Promise is the only accelerated learning opportunity available to those students in those schools, so we're providing additional access. As you can see, over half of our students were female, which echoes the demographics of the state as a whole. And in keeping with your we go fast, this is my last slide. So key aspects of our program. Again, this is a program around student learning and preparation for college, not for Western Oregon University, but for college in general. High school teachers work with our faculty, and our being collective. So we have Oregon Tech faculty, we have Corbin faculty, and other universities and college faculty who are working closely with teachers. And this is a big change over what happened, recently. We have our faculty working in these PLCs, which are professional learning communities, working with the teachers who are delivering our courses around assessments, around learning outcomes, and then going back and working with each other over time to make sure that we're all going the same direction, that, in fact, the learning that we think the course represents is being achieved and is being validated. This is a different model. I think it's one that's healthy. Our faculty at the university have learned a great deal. And the interesting paradigm is that our university faculty are the content experts in these conversations. However, the high school teachers, they're the instructional experts. They're the ones who actually know how to manage a classroom, how to work with these students, and they do it every day with great success. So it's been a great two-way learning opportunity for both the teachers and the university faculty involved. As you can see, we cross-score 20% of the work so that it isn't just one teacher saying this is an A work, this is a B work, but rather they're saying it's an A and B work, and someone else is coming behind them and validating that work at a random sample. So it has a real degree of rigor to it. And finally, even though it's in the second year, Western Oregon University has had its initial group of students come through here. And we looked at the students in the Willamette Promise route versus the Advanced Placement, which I think we're all very familiar with. And we found that the Willamette Promise students were more likely to be from lower income backgrounds, actually had a higher Western Oregon University GPA at the end of the first year, had a higher retention rate at the end of the first year. And so we're very pleased with the direction the program is going. It's a wonderful collaboration, and it's something that I think holds great promise to really looking at how do we streamline the process, how do we get to providing high school students college credit opportunities by really invigorating the curriculum and the instruction that's occurring to them. So with that, I'm open to any questions, Chair Reardon.
Any questions? You used up all our questions, I guess.
Advantage of speaking fast.
Sorry, I wasn't here for it, but I saw the PLCs and the collaboration between high school or K-12 and community colleges. How is that staff time compensated or paid? K-12's. Splitting the cost. How do you get pull out time for those?
Absolutely. Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, the funding is a mutual source funding. So the high school teachers are teaching the classes they normally would. So there is some additional stipend provided to the teachers, right around $1,000 for the year. The university faculty, at least at Western Oregon, our engaged faculty, we give a one course release time. So they teach one fewer course over the course of the year so that they can really be the lead or highly active PLC contributors, as well as kind of overseeing the cross scoring that occurs.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Just a real quick question. Are you having to hire subs as well and to relieve somebody from a teaching?
Chair Reardon, at the university, certainly that release time does mean that we will have that same course taught by another faculty member, okay. Sometimes an adjunct at a lower cost. For the high school teacher, there is occasionally some sub expenses as they attend the PLCs. One of the PLCs occurs during the summer, but there are some during school year events, in which case the district would pay for a sub to cover that biology teacher coming to work with their colleagues.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. Oops. Good. No, we love the questions.
All kinds of questions today. Thank you for the presentation. This sounds like a super amazing program. And I'm curious, Western Oregon University, my alma mater, by the way, undergrad, they have an awesome education program, our teaching education program. Curious, the PLC, the professional learning communities, is that part of the new teaching model, or is that something that is now incorporated or planning on incorporating this into the education program?
Chair Reardon, Representative Alonzo, it's always great to hear from an alum, and we certainly invite you to come back and check out the new facilities that we just opened up this year. The PLCs has been a really wonderful movement within K-12 for the last decade plus, and one of the advantages of the Willamette Promise is that it allowed us as a university partner to actually learn more about that. So our instruction of our current teaching candidates involves some exposure to PLCs. We asked during their placements in schools that their mentor teacher also include them in that practice. And as I'm sure you're aware, some of those PLCs in districts are incredibly rich and very fruitful, and other times they're not quite as strong and good, but we're working to try to develop a better model.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Write it out for the remaining 6 minutes.
Good afternoon, Chair Reardon and members of the committee. I will definitely try to keep this short, but for the record, my name is Carlene Dragostar, and I'm a practitioner for Oregon Tech working in the Office of Academic Agreements. And as David kind of alluded to earlier, I work in part with Willamette Promise and other groups in the state of Oregon to really work on accelerated credit initiatives. So that said, I'm here today representing Oregon Tech, but I'm really talking about the South Metro Salem STEM Hub. We are one of Oregon's 11 STEM hubs who are actively participating in building a network and energy around accelerating STEM education, which will ultimately impact pathways for K-12 students in STEM fields. Oregon Tech supports the STEM Hub both financially and physically. They're housed on our campus in Wilsonville. And we have our institution has taken a leadership role in executing the core mission of the STEM Hub by chairing one of their primary work groups, which is the Accelerated Credit Group, and also having a commitment to consistently engaging in the work of the partnership. Oregon Tech believes that our collective concern to ignite interest in STEM fields begins at the earliest stages of a child's development. And we are truly committed in building that ecosystem that fosters a level of development and engagement for students. So let me quickly, I was going to talk about principles, but I don't think in the interest of time we have really the ability to go through that. I want to talk about our partnerships. There was really Chair Reardon said earlier about career pathways and how industry gets involved. At the core of the South Metro Salem STEM partnership is really about a collaborative effort to bring people together. So we're working with 16 districts in the region, three community colleges, three universities, and a number of community organizations and industry partners to really help advise us around STEM learning. That said, why STEM and why now? I'm not going to bore you with all of this because really it is integrated into every aspect of our life. We often hear about it, and all of you as members of the legislature will really be ignited by the economic development opportunities around STEM, but it's really also about civic engagement of our students. So why STEM? Because it is the most, for us, the most important thing that we are focused on at this time. And it's really an immediate concern to commit to strong educational initiatives to inspire youth. So what the South Metro Salem STEM Partnership is doing is bringing all of these groups together around three core initiatives. And what this slide attempts to do is really look at our core initiatives on the left side. And what we're trying to get to is really to build a talent pool for Oregon's economy. So we're engaged in three really strong strategies to ultimately, by 2025, increase the percentage of students that are math and science proficient and increase the STEM degrees that we're ultimately graduating students out of here in the state of Oregon, with the intention that that's going to impact our economy. Let me go back one really quickly. So let me talk really quickly about the three core strategies. The first one is our STEM leadership team. And what this does is it takes teachers and brings them together in professional learning communities. But instead of around accelerated credit, what we're trying to do is really start to build STEM attributes into our science and math classes. Those attributes are about contextualizing STEM learning and bringing real-world applications into the classroom. So right now, we're working with about 200 teachers over the past 3 years. Again, this is really about project-based approach to learning. And all of our 16 districts with their core STEM teachers who are involved in these leadership teams are implementing STEM plans within their districts. So they're not just doing it in their classroom, but they're really becoming leaders within their building to move the STEM dial and move around really an integrated plan on engaging students in STEM. The next part is bringing back this whole idea of industry and connecting industry into the classroom. So we're doing this in two ways. We have an online website, so it's at stemoregon.org, and that's really a place for the state to begin to populate what is happening in STEM fields and how we're getting that information out to our districts. But more than that, what we're trying to do is to really bring that real-world experience into the classroom. And we're doing that through a tool that's powered by NEPRIS. It's called Oregon Connections. And it's really a virtual connection into the classroom. So how someone who's working at Intel can connect on their lunch hour into a classroom and really, again, contextualize the whole experience about what those students are learning in the classroom. We're calling this, it's like dating online, essentially. For teachers and industry members, but a teacher puts up a profile about what they're really engaged in and where they need help in the classroom to inspire students, and thus the industry members put their profile in, and the tool matches them. We piloted it in the STEM Hub here in the South Metro Salem STEM Hub, and it's now going statewide. And then lastly, the work that I'm really involved in is with accelerated credit. And so we're working with groups like the Willamette Promise to really get intentional science, engineering, math accelerated credit into our high schools. You can see how we've impacted with the number of credits for our first round of accelerated credit. And now we're moving on with helping our districts transition students into those STEM careers. So we're working with counselors at how we can get better around STEM advising and STEM degree advising. And we're also working on equity pieces, so really kind of challenging our assumptions on who our STEM students are and how we work around that to move the dial for equity and getting more students involved in STEM degrees. I thank you today for listening, and I'm moving along quickly. So
and thank you. And how can anybody cut somebody off that's so excited about what they're doing? So,
yeah.
Rep. Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How could you do all this without us telling you to do it? You know, I mean, God, what are we? Go for it. Go for it, lady.
Chair Rudin and Representative Winsam. I would say for working at Oregon Tech, I've never seen so much passion around STEM education. But more than that, what our leaders were doing in the area as we began to transition into our Wilsonville location was really to evaluate the landscape and what our industry needs were. So PCC mentioned earlier having advisory boards that are talking to their faculty and really helping them look at their curriculum and what's working and what isn't. We're doing that at the same level at the universities. We're really trying to talk to industry about what they need. And that's where this all of this really hard work came out of, is trying to connect the pieces. And I think that the state has really invested in these STEM hubs. There's now 11 of them. And so it's building a network. And although you maybe didn't tell us to do it, you're definitely supporting serving us in a way that is wonderful. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Chair. So you mentioned there's 11 STEM hubs, and then you had talked about, like, the area that I am from has the Portland Metro STEM Partnership. So it's my understanding that not every STEM hub operates the same way. So yours is a more 16 school districts, where Portland Metro may do a more concentrated effort at certain schools. So when you talked about evaluating the landscape, so what tell me what the is there a timeline of where you're all going to come together and say what hub did, you know, what were the challenges, what were the successes, and should we mix it up a bit?
Yeah, Chair Reardon, Representative Solomon. So that's a really great question, and I'll give you my perspective of how I see that kind of landscaping evolving. The STEM hubs seem to be working closely together, but they all have very different strategies that are really geared towards their region, and what they're attempting to do is share those practices. So in our strategies, we're constantly coming together as a group to really share best practices and what's working, and the STEM hubs are coming together. So I think it was STEMapalooza or something like that just recently, where everyone was together with industry talking about what's working. So it is happening, but I think each region is really defining what their strategies are and picking up on other strategies as we see them working.
I'm just going to say the Wilsonville OIT is impressive. We saw them building 3D copiers to build 3D copiers. That's amazing.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we still have Colorado waiting for us, but Kyle, you've come a long way. From Corvallis, no
Representative
pressure.
Representative Reardon and committee, I have the coveted final speaking spot with negative 5 minutes to talk. So I was trying to think of how I'm going to summarize this. And
Speak backwards.
I'll just say Oregon State University is the land-grant university for Oregon, and we have the responsibility of providing pathways to ensure that all Oregonians have the opportunity to prosper and advance in their communities. And so I wanted to focus a little bit on rural communities, and I hope negative 5 minutes isn't reflective of overall resource. But OSU has a ton of pre-college programs, 98 youth-serving programs. My office funds and directs around 20 of them. We definitely have a STEM focus. Go ahead and advance that. I really want to tell you about three programs that form this pipeline that begins in K-12, which we haven't talked about many specifics. One is the Science and Math Investigative Learning Experiences Program, SMILE. It turns 30 this fall. Mm-hmm. It's started, funded by the legislature through OUS 30 years ago. It's 4th through 12th grade after school clubs where students get to do hands-on experiences.
Excuse me, Mr. Cole. We got excited.
We're done.
I forgot to ask you your name for the record.
For the record, I am Kyle Cole. I'm the director of OSU Pre-College Programs and SMILE.
Okay.
I thought I said that. But
thank you.
That negative. I would take a negative couple of minutes there. So we have these after-school clubs. It's a pipeline from 4th through 12th grade, okay? So a student can be in there for 9 years. Last year, 100% of the seniors who are in SMILE graduated. Now, these are in rural communities where the graduation rate for the high school is 65%. SMILE is also unique in that we serve only underserved and upper-represented students. You have to be a minority, low-income, underrepresented in STEM, 44% Latinos, 66% low-income, 81% first-generation college students last year. So that's a great pipeline program. In fact, we are coming for our middle school challenge. The students get to visit Western tomorrow and then come to OSU for this engineering challenge overnight. Fantastic experience. That's where I'm going as soon as I'm done. So another one is rural communities. During the summer programming gap is when minority and low-income students really fall behind in that achievement gap. And so we created these mobile STEM camps to go into rural communities to really bridge that summer programming gap for these students. So it was this year, I'll just say that we doubled the number of camps thanks to the CTE and STEM activity grants through the STEM hubs and the CTE grants that went out through the STEM hub. So we had 18 camps this last summer, over 300 students served talking about careers and going to college. Finally, we haven't really talked about peer mentoring, but peer mentoring, believe me, we can talk about going to college, but having a college student talk to a student about going to college is way more impactful. So we have a program called Beaver Hangouts. It's an online mentoring program. College students Skype into classrooms across the state. We started with one mentor 3 years ago with 60 third graders. This year, we have 65 college student mentors. They're Skyping into 68 classrooms, over 750 K-12 students. We do not talk about just going to college. We talk about community college, degree pathways, career pathways through community college. This isn't sort of a recruitment for OSU. It's college access, and community colleges are by far the best choice for some students. We also talk about military career pathways, et cetera. So great K-12 pipeline, right? So it used to be you were off of the diving board into college. Awesome. So now there are summer bridge programs. Some of them were mentioned. These are residential experiences, very important. SMILE has one. LSAMP has one. CAMP, there are other ones. So let's go straight now to two undergraduate success programs. So we've gotten them through K-12, gotten them psyched, gotten them into college through the bridge program. Now what do you do your first year? There are two excellent programs for STEM education. One you might have heard of, the Louise Stokes Alliance for Minority Participation, LSAMP. That was expanded to other universities through an ODE grant this year. The other one is STEM Leaders. This is a really awesome program where students get to do research, paid research, their first year. So when a student comes in and they're from a low-income background, yeah, they can go take the major, but when it comes to volunteering to do research, high-impact practice, they have to get a job. So they don't get that opportunity. So this pays for them to do research their first year. And so this retention rate from the first to second year in the programs, 93% to 98%, and I can't tell you just how that compares to these students who just even going on to college the second year. I just want to point out two students here. One is Anna Aranda on the left. She's one of the STEM leaders who her grandparents found Centro Cultural in 1972 in Portland. And then on the right is Carolina Guyen, who was in the mobile STEM camps. So she did this, then she goes back in the summer to talk to these, to deliver these STEM camps. And then finally on the right, I had to show a picture of the most awesome one-legged robot that is an incredible thing to watch walk. Finally, I'm going to conclude with this very brief pipeline we talked about. So this is a student, Nina Flores. She is currently a STEM leader. She began SMILE in fourth grade. She's visited PCC. She went to Eastern and Southern. She went through SMILE all the way through eighth grade. In between in eighth and ninth grade, middle school, there are the mobile STEM camps, and I'm really only able to present a small portion. The STEM hubs do a ton of programming in K-12. Finally, in high school, she went through SMILE. This is where Beaver Hangouts would come in and start planning for college and talking about college. In between 12th grade and college, there was the Summer Bridge program. She went through the SMILE Summer Bridge program. And now in college, she's in the STEM Leaders program and part of LSAMP and is now Skyping back into these communities so that students can see someone like themselves who's gotten into college, who's gone through SMILE. Oh. So I really want to wrap this up. You know, my job was to sort of conclude all of this. And there's a lot of programs that you've heard about, and I want to leave you with the sense that there is a lot of collaboration. There are a lot of intersections with funding through the STEM hubs, through grants, through ODE. And there's been a lot of progress so that we do have this continuous pipeline and these articulation points of degrees. All right, that took way more than negative 5 minutes. But thank you. If there are any questions?
Ripper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, did you reference a number 65% of rural students graduate high school, only 65%? Was that a number I heard?
No. Well, I use that statistic as an example of a typical high school graduation rate, but that was for Ontario High School, which is where we have a SMILE club. And so that's in that school, 100% of the SMILE students, all of them graduated. The average for the whole high school, 65. The average for low-income Latino students is lower.
Quick follow-up.
Yeah, please.
Thank you. Do we have any data? Maybe there's a better group to ask, but do we have any data on the breakdown as far as boys and girls, as far as what percentage of that 35% that didn't graduate? Was it 60% boys who didn't graduate, 40% women? What do we know?
Representative Reardon, Representative Hurd. Two responses. One is there's definitely a better group to answer this, but I happen to know the data. So men are at greater risk of falling out of school at every single level, K-12, community college, university. So the dropout rate for women will be lower than the dropout rate for men. Women are just plain more successful than we are at every economic level.
Okay, Rep. Alonzo Leon, last question of the group.
I just want to acknowledge the SMILE program because I went through it when I was in middle school.
Oh, you were?
I was a SMILE, yes, and went through SMILE camp as well and took sophomore physics. That was the courses that I took at OSU. So I want to acknowledge that program because it's incredibly successful and incredibly beneficial to students. That was my first exposure to college, an institution, a university. So I want to just quickly say a shout out, but also the mentoring program. OSU also had a mentoring program when I was in middle school and into high school. Yeah. So that's also an invaluable program for students, and I really appreciate your comment, Kyle, around having professionals of color that look like them. Students will always want to aspire to become professionals, but if they don't see themselves in other professions, it's very challenging. But when they do, it's amazing. It's amazing turnaround for them who are on the fence of going to college or not, and they see somebody who looks like them, then they aspire to do that. So thank you for all of your work, everybody. Thank you.
Thank all of you. I think we could chat all afternoon, but we've definitely run out of time. Appreciate your all being here. Very informative. And I want to hold any other questions I have, so thank you again.
Thank you.
So I call Laura Roach up, and our friends in Colorado, we'll have to reschedule them. I regret that, but technical difficulties. But it seems to have worked out really well. I'm glad we did not miss any of the presentations we've heard today. They've all been very valuable. So,
Mr. Chair, while they're getting set up.
Yeah, Ripper.
I know we don't have a lot of data to focus on that, but I think it is interesting that we're seeing across the board, and great for the ladies, I love it, how successful women are becoming in this era. But I would like to think that we want to focus on trying to tweak whatever we need to from a curriculum standpoint or what have you at the lower education levels to keep the boys being maximum productive as well to help overall society benefit. So that's something I'd like to see the committee at some point, if we could, maybe dive into a little deeper.
Yeah, we'll definitely make a note of that.
All right, thank you.
Laura, welcome.
You get to
wrap up.
I know, and I'm going to move fast.
And you have to... You know, we've had some pretty stunning presentations here today, so we're looking for quite a bit.
Oh, okay, thank you. Well, Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Laura Roach. I'm in the Department of Education, and I serve as the director of the secondary post-secondary transition teams with primary responsibility on career and technical education and STEM-funded programs. I was asked today to talk a little bit about student pathways, in particular CTE, and a little bit about dual credit. So we're going to share a little information with you. I believe in our packets we gave you both a one-pager on dual credit progress and also our CTE state report card. So if you're looking for some specific data, you may find it there, although there's plenty of data in here, probably more than you want to see. So first of all, let me just say that at the high school level, we always have to remember that in Oregon, we're a comprehensive high school system, which is unlike a lot of states where they have career and technical education centers and a lot of different kinds of structures for CTE. But in Oregon, we're a comprehensive high school student. So when we're talking about pathways for K-12, we're talking about both academic pathways and career-focused pathways. And those are intertwined, because you can't do a CTE pathway without an academic structure to go with it, or an academic pathway to the university without some relatively important skill sets that will help you in a career area. In addition, our diploma requirements have 3 credits for CTE and then an additional 6 credits of electives. So when we look at this and we think about what's going on, we know there's both academic content standards and what we call our Oregon skill set, which are industry standards for career and technical education. And another piece of that set is called the Common Career Technical Core, which is a national set of standards. These are validated by business and industry to help students understand what they need to know and be able to do, not only to do a technical type of job, but also workplace skill sets, those kinds of things. Important to any student's pathway is a student plan, and this is still part of our Oregon diploma, which allows a student to identify their personal and academic career interests, set some goals, and know their next steps, and participates in planning their learning experiences. And the department is revisiting the very important concept of personalized learning and credit for proficiency as we move forward for our next generation of students. Some of that seemed to become overshadowed by the No Child Left Behind and the very strong academic focus, and so we're trying to bring back a focus there as we move forward. There are different kinds of credit options that serve our students. There are certainly foundational credit options with post-secondary. There are interest-based electives with post-secondary credit around career-focused CTE. There's advanced placement and IB, and then specialized courses and projects. All of these things help to build the foundation for a student to move into post-secondary education and to go forward with credit that was useful to them in their next step. What is really important, and really we are struggling to also rebuild in our K-12 system, is counseling support and guidance. And these are some of the resources that we have. But what I would say is across 197 school districts and 300 high schools, services are drastically different. And they may be drastically different even within a district, depending on their resources. But we have school counselors, we have some career centers, we have teacher advisors, we have external organizations who are helping us, we have the career information system, and student organizations that are tied to CTE, special education transition specialists. All of these folks are available and supporting our students, but again, our capacity to provide this consistency across the state is very challenging.
Could you give us some idea of how we're doing on staffing counselors and career guidance?
Well, I don't know that I'm the factual person, but Beth is back there. We know that in some schools it's 1 to 500 students, but Beth is back there. Beth, would you like to get an answer from her? Sure.
Yes, please.
Beth, are you joining? Beth is our Department of Education Career Guidance and Counseling person. Could you introduce yourself and
just state your name for the record?
My name is Beth Wiggum with the Oregon Department of Education. And some of the recent statistics that's come out of the Oregon Department of Education is almost up into 600, the 600s to one at this time.
Statewide average?
Yeah.
Okay. Rep. Johnson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I get you to go back one slide, please?
Maybe.
College credit.
I am left-handed, right-eyed, so sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Is that the one you want? One more?
One more.
That one.
There you go. Is that it?
Is that what you're
College credit options. Okay, interest-based electives. All right. What I'm hoping we'll see is, and what we're hearing about that needs to be done, is intentional alignment between ODE, CCWD on these credits to ensure that there's value at the next level, that we're not just giving students the option of just taking something that, you know, it seems fun or exciting or whatever, but, again, we're wasting credit options. We're not maximizing the opportunities if these aren't a part of a it could be the bucket of the associate, you know, the AAOT, the Oregon Transfer Module, or whatever, but there just needs to be alignment there. And I know that there's some efforts there, but I really, really want to encourage more intentional alignment there. Because, again, as we talk about staff time, student time, everything, we just need to make sure we're getting our bang for the buck.
Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, I definitely appreciate your comment, and we are hearing a lot about that. One of the things that's interesting that also kind of gave us an opportunity when Measure 98 emerged was to revisit the definition of a CTE course, because in the diploma, when the department put in six credits, it meant you could have or three credits of CTE, it could be anything. So when Measure 98 came forward, we came forward with a definition of a CTE course, because we knew, we do know that when a course is properly defined in sequence, that it will have a benefit to the students. So we're doing that work on the front end, and then we're also, you'll see some conversation about that specific alignment and the effect, I think, a little bit later.
Glad to hear you say that, because I think Measure 97 will drive that discussion. It's going to have to happen.
Right. And we've got one more question. Rep. Wiseman?
Just real quick, the next slide, your that well, it came up the counseling. I attended the big counseling thing we had at Central Oregon Community College, and also visited my high school at Ben Lapine. And even the number of counselors we have, they're spending 60% or more of their time on social issues and family issues, not in helping you get to college or get a scholarship.
Representative Reardon and Chair Wisnett, we are really aware of that and are talking about that extensively in the department and have that concern. And again, when we talked about Measure 98 and some of the things that small schools needed, the first thing they mentioned was mental health services. So we are hearing that from around the state. And then we also are very aware that our counselors are still being used often just primarily for scheduling. I mentioned to you, I think a couple years ago, that Georgia, I believe it was, I'm not actually sure, passed a law that school counselors could only do school counseling.
What really scared me was there was a significant number on suicide watch of high school students.
Oh, sure.
That's scary.
So some of the resources that the state has helped us with over the past few years, and this was particularly in the last legislative session to support these opportunities for CTE, include the revitalization grants, the CTE pathway grants, the regional promise grants, APM IB test fee. You guys can read those, but they are all been incredibly important. And up until about 4 or 5 years ago, we actually only had, beyond the state school fund, we only had Perkins federal funds to support CTE, and that $13 million has diminished over time, but that $13 million is also divided equally between high schools and community colleges. Mm-hmm. So actually, K-12 would only really be receiving around $6.5 million. So we might talk for a few minutes about career and technical education. We have grown with your help, with your dedicated investment. We've grown about 100 additional programs. Right now, the six career areas, and these are very broad career areas. On the left, you see the number of programs that we have currently registered with us. And these are programs of study. These are not just courses, not just electives, but they have at least two credits in a sequence of courses. And that varies across the state based on capacity, how many credits a program can have. If I'm lucky, I'll show you the map, but I may not be that lucky today. I don't know if I can do it or not. You're going to be interested to know that I use a mouse upside down. So sometimes I'm not able to make these things happen. I don't think I can make it happen today. But we do have the maps across the state of all the programs. The secondary programs, the study pathways, right now we have 711 across the state. That we served about 48,000 students that are doing a half credit in a sequence of courses. 26 of our, we're only really serving about 26% of our high school students. 100% of our programs are aligned to college pathways. In 2006, when the Carl Perkins Act was passed, we convened a state task force, and the task force agreed that all programs that we would invest in would be aligned to industry standards as well as academic standards. And all programs that we would invest in would have a post-secondary partner. Now, that was a huge undertaking on our part because that was 600 programs, and then taking some of these small school programs and trying to find a community college. For example, in Southern Oregon, they had a great little radio program, but there was no college in Southern Oregon that had a radio program for them to align to. So rather than give it up, they aligned to Mount Hood Community College. Well, that was a big stretch to make that post-secondary connection happen and to show students those pathways. But we have done that, and we attempted to do about 200 programs a year over 4 years, trying to bring all those programs into some kind of alignment. Many of these programs have dual credit. In reference to Representative Johnson's question, there are students who move between pathways in their high school situation, and so they may acquire some credits that may not take them to a post-secondary or be used in a certificate. I challenge that thinking a little bit on the other side, in that if that's a course that keeps a student in a high school, that's important. If that course is meaningful and it keeps them engaged, that's important. Although I do understand, and we have talked a lot about, you can only acquire credits, I think it's 100 at 150%, or you'll affect your financial aid.
Right.
So that's a conversation we're going to have to work on in the future and really streamline those credits and make sure they have a home in the next program.
Rep. Solomon has a question.
Thank you, Chair. And I also just wanted to add on that, too. Don't you feel like, I feel like in high school, students should be exploring that pathway as well. It should be a time for them to explore that so that they have those opportunities, so that they invest their time there versus exploring those options when they're paying the larger bucks for them in college. So do you...
Chair Reardon and Rep. Solomon, I absolutely agree with you. And we also know and understand that taking a course and deciding that course is not for you is very beneficial as well. That's a part of the growing process and learning. Maybe I thought I was interested in being a veterinarian, but after I got into that class, I found out that I didn't want to take 8 years of university instruction, and nor did I want to
work with dogs.
So that's part of the exploration, but I do think we do know that a sequence of courses and a student staying in a pathway of some kind directly affects their graduation rate. Mm-hmm. Our data supports that. An example of a career pathway, McMinnville High School is one of the high schools that has laid out their courses. They're fortunate in that they have a large enough high school to offer multiple courses over time. They also acknowledge CTE students that graduate within a pathway, but they also might not offer every one of those courses every year. There might be alternate years in which courses are offered depending on their actual capacity. So we've heard a lot about, I can't offer a two-credit program in a rural area, but almost all of our high schools have at least one program of two credits, and in some cases they just alternate years of when the credits are offered. So there's been some creative design taking place in order to make sure that our high schools can participate and offer at least something to our students. But many high schools just have one course, and if you're not into agriculture or one program of study, if you're not into agriculture, that's it. That's the maximum capacity they might have. These were just some comments from some of our school districts, and they're embedded in the report card that's with your package. But I think you can see here that our principals and superintendents are acknowledging the vital role that CTE is playing, that they're acknowledging the partners that make it happen. One of the things about CTE is it needs its industry partners and it needs its community partners to be successful. We have great teachers and we have great faculty, but we also have to have our industry partners. And part of the program to study design is that they have an industry advisory committee. We also see in here the acknowledgement of the role of guidance counselors in that process. So it's very important that we have these kinds of supports for CTE. David Douglas is another example of a high school that has a 91% graduation rate. All 3,000 students have a one-to-one meeting to solidify their plans and ensure a schedule that meets their needs. That's pretty amazing, and that's a pretty high commitment. So
I just have to say, I mean, that's a school. I just got to say it. Sorry.
They're waiting.
25% English language learners and 80% free and reduced lunch, and they're performing at that level. So, here.
We also found in our data that's in that report that I gave you that students of color and underserved students do very, very well when they're offered CTE. It is very impressive the amount of jump in their graduation rates. We have been very fortunate to be able to pull some data that generally shows that our CTE concentrators, that would be two or more credits, are graduating about 15 points higher than the state average. The engagement, the attention, the support, the opportunity to do project-based learning, to collaborate, all of these things are factors along with a good quality school system. CTE can't do it alone. We're part of a comprehensive high school, but we do offer a pathway for students. And the dual credit students are earning more than 9 credits in the high school and have higher college participation rates and greater persistence the second year of college. So our data is showing that what we're doing is the right thing, and your continued support is incredibly important. Around accelerated learning, Janelle Ives is here with us. She is our leader in the Department of Education. She provided us some enrollment data based on what's happened in 15-16. We have over 57,000, almost 58,000 students participating now in dual credit. We've seen a great expansion in rural high schools as a result of the Regional Promise investment. If you can see here, there is a significant growth from 18% to 54% in 2013-14. The previous years was 13 to 18%. So this is a really impressive progress within a biennium. Also, within the Regional Promise courses, course taken increased 226%. So again, your investments are really paying off. And the attention and support that students and teachers are receiving is making a difference. Those schools that did not have a Regional Promise course taken increased by 84%. Cross-sector collaboration, as you've heard earlier in the presentation, has been a significant part of this work. Faculty and high school teachers working together, and particularly having the time and the investment of resources to sit down and work side by side to align the curriculum. That is really hard and challenging work, and it takes a lot of time and energy to bring it together. 83 professional learning communities were formed since 2015. 752 high school teachers were engaged, 172 counselors, and 147 post-secondary faculty were reported. So again, seeing that impact, and that's both across academic and within the engagement of CTE as well. There are lots of lessons learned and lots of challenges for us. Essential to successful pathways for students are targeted investments. We absolutely need to continue to target those investments so we can leverage them, and that money can really be focused on what students actually need and teachers actually need. We absolutely have to continue our partnership and collaboration work. Teachers and faculty cannot do it alone. They need their business and industry partners. They need public and private partnerships, workforce centers, all of those people. That is time-consuming work, and it does take teachers from the classroom. It does create substitute cost. It does do a lot of things, but I think what we're seeing is the benefit of that work. And more importantly, it brings our communities back into our classrooms. It gives them a voice that sometimes they haven't had for a while. There are many, many challenges from the high school side of the fence. Time, money, intentional credit and transfer, we mentioned that. Helping our teachers and our students understand that choosing credits that will transfer or be useful in the next step is an important part of that work. Another piece that we ran into when I talked to McMinnville High School the other day, they are one of the leaders in dual credit, but their students might also have five transcripts from five different colleges that they need to track because of the variety of programs students take. So that was a kind of a reminder how complicated it can be for high school students to acquire those transcripts and make sure that things get transferred to the next institution and used. We definitely need a shift in the role of the counselor, and we need more communication to students about pathway availability, and certainly culturally responsiveness training and support is very important as our population demographics change.
Chair, do we have time for one question?
We have one.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you about the multiple transcripts issue. One of the things that I'm working on is the ability for the counselors to consolidate the transcript and make sure that the kids can even make it out of high school, especially if they've been to different districts. And this affects military kids, foster students, migrant students, kids in the foster care system. I don't remember if I said that. But can you talk a little bit about the challenges of the multiple transcripts and what barriers we can remove to make sure those kids can make it out?
Chair Reardon and Representative Bynum, is that correct?
Yes.
This was a conversation we had at the personalized learning program last week, and really it was just a matter of students get a choice, and in order to make these alignments work, there can be multiple community colleges. Okay. And it simply means that someone has to help those students, whether it's a parent or the counselor, get those transcripts, and in some cases you may have to pay for those transcripts. I don't know that for a fact. Okay. And getting those back together. How we do that, I don't know. Maybe that's okay. Been a conversation that's been held with some of the other groups, but if we have some recommendations, I will certainly see that our staff brings them back to you.
Okay.
And I appreciate the fact that you're working on that, because we can just think about these students who are doing this and acquiring this these credits, and then having to contact different institutions to see that they get that paperwork transferred.
Okay.
Instructor licensure, we've been working on that, particularly in the area of CTE, has been a factor in some of our challenges. In the Department of Education, we work with some of the alternative teacher licensure, and it turns out so far it's about 65 teachers a year that we are working with to try to get them alternative licensure. We have some new recommendations that will be heard by TSPC this April that will open up that door and make things a little bit easier. So we're positive about that. And you can see the other opportunities there that have to be developed in order for our students to have clear and accessible pathways beyond what's offered in the high school. We need some additional career development for our counselors. Many of them are professionals and they have training, but if you just think about how our workforce is changing, how our career options are changing, how the job, we don't even know what the jobs in the next 10 years will be. So unless we have capacity to bring our counselors along, it's hard for them to be effective in guiding their students. And then I think administrators have so much on their plates. Sometimes guidance and counseling is not their priority. Obviously, they have to get the schedules done, they have to get the students through, and that's challenging. And then, of course, with CTE, we are still dealing with outdated equipment and facilities, and we still are falling way short on middle school engagement. So these are some of the places where we could make additional investments or refine the investments we're already making to make sure that we are using our resources to the highest and best use. So we are excited. While there are many, many challenges, I think there are lots of opportunities, and we're seeing great progress. And we're very appreciative that we've had some dedicated resources for student pathways, for CTE, for dual credit, because we're now beginning to see that we can truly build a system that is more cohesive and really does provide students with pathways that will give them many, many options. So are there other questions that you would like to ask before you go home?
And just keep in mind that we're 2 minutes over.
Oh, sorry.
So we're not going to encourage any more questions right now. But thank you. Thank you so much. And you think about what we have accomplished in the last 5, 6, 7 years, and you've been a huge part of that. So thank you for all that you've done. We're not sure whether we'll be able to bring Colorado back, but I'm going to carry this meeting over just in case. So so we'll carry this informational hearing over with the intent to continue this conversation. And then I am closing a meeting of the House Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee. Thank you all.
Excellent.